This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Catholic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This channel and episode were created in collaboration with the American Catholic Historical Association, a conference of scholars, archivists, and teachers of Catholic studies. My name is Allison Onsador, and I'm a host of the channel. Today, we're talking with Dr. Jeroen DeWolf, Director of the Center for Portuguese Studies and Professor in the Department of German and Dutch Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Jeroen is the author of Afro-Atlantic Catholics, America's First Black Christians, published by the University of Notre Dame Press this August. Black Christianity in America has long been studied as a blend of indigenous African and Protestant elements. In Afro-Atlantic Catholics, Jeroen redirects the conversation by focusing on the enduring legacy of 17th century Afro-Atlantic Catholics in the broader history of African American Christianity. With homelands in part of Africa with historically strong Portuguese influence, such as the Cape Verde Islands, Sao Tome, and Congo, these Africans embraced variants of early modern Portuguese Catholicism that they would take with them to the Americas as part of the forced migration that was the transatlantic slave trade. Jeroen's analysis focuses on the historical documentation of Afro-Atlantic Catholic rituals, devotions, and social structures. As we will discuss, Afro-Atlantic Catholics shows how a sizable minority of enslaved Africans actively transformed the American Christian landscape and would lay a distinctly Afro-Catholic foundation for African-American religious traditions today. Jeroen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I was wondering if we could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, Allison. Well, thank you for your question. And thank you, of course, for giving me this opportunity to tell you a little bit more about my book. And maybe before I speak about myself and share some information about my biography, I could say just a few words, initial words about the book. And, you know, what makes this book important, I would say, is that it presents a new interpretation of the history of Black Christianity with a focus on Catholicism. And in that respect, it is a continuation of the important pioneering work that maybe you and some of the people who are listening to us know, the work by Father Cyprian Davis, who had important publications on this topic. And you know, what I tried to do was to just add more information and also present, I think, a new perspective on this history. And what makes this book different, right? What makes this book different is that traditionally, the idea is that enslaved Africans brought to the Americas their indigenous religions with them, and then gradually they became familiar with Christianity. In North America, this was predominantly a Protestant Christianity. In Latin America, a Catholic Christianity. But nevertheless, right, the way in which members of the Black community expressed their Christian faith revealed that there were differences, right? And these differences have traditionally been explained with references to kind of indigenous African elements that then merged with Protestant Christianity, with Catholic Christianity. And what I essentially say in my book is that we need to add a third element to this discussion. Yeah? And so I don't deny the importance of missionary work in the Americas. I don't deny the importance of indigenous African elements that were brought to the Americas. But my point is that in order to properly understand why the expression of Christian faith, either among Protestants or among Catholics, among members of the Black communities all over the Americas is different, we need to add a third element to the discussion. And what is this third element? That third element is that especially in the early decades of the transatlantic slave trade, a significant percentage of Africans already identified as Christian before their arrival. Yeah? That's essentially the central point I make. Yeah? And I call these people Afro-Atlantic Catholics, yeah? Because it was a Catholic form of Christianity that started in Africa and then spread to the Americas, hence the term Afro-Atlantic. And although these were relatively small groups of people, it is important to stress that they were the first ones, and they were the first Black Christians in the Americas. And therefore, what I try to demonstrate in my book is that they were to have a major influence on the religious, the social, the cultural identity formation of Black communities all over the Americas, including here in North America. And that brings me also then to my biography. Right? Because why do I look at this history from a different perspective? And that certainly has to do, partly at least, with the fact that I came relatively late to the United States. I was not educated in the United States. I grew up as a Catholic in the Flemish part of Belgium. And I later spent over 10 years of my life in Portugal, also in Brazil. And then I came to Berkeley in 2007, where, as you said, I direct the Dutch Studies program, also director currently of the Institute of European Studies and its Center for Portuguese Studies. Very interested in both Dutch and Portuguese colonial history, especially cultural and social aspects of it. And I think what was very important for this book in particular was that while living in Portugal and Brazil, I became fascinated with the Catholicism that in many ways was different from the type of Catholicism I was familiar with in Belgium. And I became especially fascinated with the Catholicism of members of Brazil's Black community. You know, a type of Catholicism where the role of saints is crucial, the role of the Virgin Mary, the importance of making vows, you know, promises to saints, the importance of processions with drum music and dance. And I brought all of this with me when I came to the United States in 2007. And when finding original sources about Black communities here in North America, and then looking at how historians in North America had interpreted those stories, I felt uncomfortable with some of the interpretations. And why was that? Well, essentially what I felt is that the traditional perspective on those sources had been an Anglo-Saxon perspective. Yeah. And my perspective, of course, considering my own background, was much more an Iberian perspective. And that made me, I think, come to different conclusions and allowed me to bring, a new perspective and present that in the book we are discussing here today.
Yeah, and, that leads us pretty much into my next question about your research methodology. You're using a comparative methodology comparing the North American sources about social, cultural, and religious practices among enslaved community members to sources from Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbeans. Can you tell us about your research process and, what were some challenges that you ran into?
Yeah. Well, let me perhaps start by saying a few words on how this book project started, actually. And it started in Manhattan. It started in Manhattan, where I was working on the early Dutch history of Manhattan, at the time when Manhattan was still called New Amsterdam in the 17th century. And I became fascinated with the information I discovered about the earliest African community in Manhattan in the 17th century. And what surprised me was that all these people had Portuguese names. Yeah, they were called Maria or Manuel or Sebastião, so typically Portuguese names, right? And that raised, a lot of questions. Well, what does that mean, right? When they have Portuguese names, does that mean, for instance, that the Portuguese language also had an importance to this community? And I did research into language, and indeed I was able to uncover some fascinating information that shows us that the first language that allowed people who came from different parts of Africa to the Americas to communicate among themselves, that first language was not English, it was not Dutch, it was not French, but it was Portuguese. An Afro-Portuguese pidgin, so to speak, that allowed these people to communicate among themselves. I then looked at culture, right? And I raised the question, if they were able to communicate in Portuguese, if they had Portuguese names, were they influenced by Portuguese cultural traditions? And I looked at this in an earlier book of mine called The Pinkster King. And all of that then led to the third question, namely the topic of religion, right? Because if these people had Portuguese names, that means something. And what it means is they had been baptized, right? They had been baptized as Catholics. They were given Iberian names. But what does that mean, right? How Catholic were they? And that, of course, is a difficult question to answer, considering that there is very little data on the earliest enslaved communities in North America, including the ones that were living in Manhattan in the 17th century. And so the only alternative for me, Alison, really was to use, as you said, was to use a comparative methodology. In other words, what you try to do is you try to look for other parts of the world where similar communities lived, right? And then you try to find out, is there more information in other parts of the world that can help us understand what may have occurred within these communities in North America? And that's not an easy thing to do. It means that you have to, do a tremendous amount of reading. This book is really the result of more than 10 years of research. It's, of course, reading in multiple languages. And here, one of the advantages of growing up in the Flemish part of Belgium is that already at young age, you become fluent in other foreign languages. Right? So I used sources in Latin, in Italian, Portuguese, Spanish, French, Dutch, German, because without those languages, you can't really access those sources. Of course, I had my limitations as well. That's obvious. Most of my research took place in Portugal, in the National Archives, the National Library, and Portugal was for me the point of departure. And all you know, all over the book, there's constant references to Portugal. And that's, I think, you know, part of what makes this book special, right? That essentially what I highlight and what I stress time and again in my book is the crucial importance of the historical Portuguese presence in Africa, in particular when it comes to understanding the development of Black Christianity. And you know, time and again, when preparing my book and writing earlier versions, I ran into studies, right, from American colleagues who denied this importance of the Portuguese presence in Africa when it comes to, you know, the development of Christianity. Even by very established scholars, right? I'm thinking of someone like John Butler, you know, who in his book speaks about an African spiritual Holocaust, right? Which is problematic because then you end up telling the history of African-American Christianity almost as if it was a white history, and it was clearly it was not, right? And it was already since the 17th century a specifically African variant of Christianity in North America, a Catholic form of Christianity. I'm also thinking of someone like Albert Raboteau, you know, a scholar I deeply respect and whose work I admire. But when I read in his famous book, Slave Religion, right, that the Portuguese presence in Africa was not really important, you can summarize that in 2-3 sentences. I don't agree, right? I don't agree, and I feel an urge to present, you know, my perspective and try to explain, you know, why I feel this is an important topic, why we need to look into that. And I hope, you know, that my book will contribute to this discussion.
Right, yeah, and you've kind of answered one of my questions I had lined up about the influence and impact of the Portuguese on these Afro-Atlantic Catholics. It's such a crucial part of your book. But, you know, you're looking at popular or folk Catholicism with, you know, a focus on rituals, that being baptisms, marriage, burial, saint devotion, so prayers, curses, ex-voodoos, vows, and social structures such as brotherhoods and confraternities. And why did you want to examine these aspects of Afro-Atlantic Catholicism? What did you find when you looked at these practices?
Yeah, well, you know, these practices are crucial here because they help us to understand why previous scholars, I think, have tended to underestimate or even to misunderstand what this Portuguese influence in Africa was all about. And there is 2 points here. You know, traditional studies, right? Traditional studies on Christianity in Africa have a tendency to focus on missionaries, right? And the role of missionaries and the importance of missionaries. And my conclusion in my book is that this perspective is wrong in the sense that it was not missionaries who were the driving force here. The driving force really was communities who embraced the new faith and then organized themselves in lay societies, a type of brotherhoods, sodalities, where they had, you know, their own form of Christianity. And they were really the driving force, much more than European missionaries who come to Africa. And the second point I stress is that the Portuguese introduced Christianity in Africa in the 15th century, right? In other words, they did so before the Council of Trent, right? And as you know, the Council of Trent would, of course, change Christianity, change Catholicism in a dramatic way in Europe. So if we want to understand the type of Christianity that was brought to Africa, we have to look at this early form of Catholicism and the way it was lived in Portuguese society. And I think that was perhaps the most crucial mistake here, that most scholars who have looked at the history of Christianity in Africa, they have tended to look at it from a post-Tridentine perspective, or even worse, from a Reformed perspective. And of course, if you do that, then you completely misunderstand the type of Christianity that the Portuguese brought to Africa, right? And this is also the reason why my book starts in Portugal, and where I raise the question, what do we know about this pre-Tridentine form of Catholicism that the Portuguese would then take to Africa, right? And perhaps I can mention two characteristics of it that, that are crucial. The first one is the role of saints, right? And the practice of making vows to saints, so making promises, right? You make, in a way, a deal with a saint, right? And then you have to stick to that deal, because a typical characteristic of Tridentine Catholicism is that, you know, saints are tricky, and saints can be jealous, can even be vengeful if you make a promise and then you don't stick to your word, right? Equally important is the tremendous concern with spiritual afterlife, or what the Portuguese used to call uma boa morte, so a good death, where it was believed that as long as a promise you made remained unfulfilled, because it could happen, right? You make a promise to Saint Anthony, for instance, and then all of a sudden you pass away. And so it was, people believed that if that happens, you have a major problem, because it means that your soul will be in trouble. Yeah, or your soul will be in pain, and then others have to fulfill your promise, etc. So there was all these concerns about making vows and making sure that those vows are fulfilled. And then the second aspect was the role of brotherhoods, right? It was really in the form of brotherhoods that Christians formed a congregation, honored tradition, practiced rituals, and provided solidarity with their brothers and sisters, both the living and the deceased, right? So these are two very important characteristics that I stress really in my book. And then from Portugal, I move on, right? And then I go to Africa. And I begin, of course, in the Cape Verde Islands, as you mentioned before. Cape Verde Islands, a crucial place in the world to understand Black Christianity, because this is where this story begins, right? It's the earliest place in Africa where you have Portuguese colonization, and then you have people who were brought to these islands as enslaved people, become familiar with this early form of Catholicism, and they are the ones then to arrive in the Americas as America's first Black Christians. Yeah, and I'm very surprised, Alison, to be honest with you, how little research scholars in the United States have done about the Cape Verde Islands. Yeah, crucial place in the world, I would say, to understand the transatlantic slavery. Very important, of course, the Congo region. Yeah, because when we speak about numbers, yeah, then of course the Congo region is much more important. Great research here that I could take advantage of, research by scholars like John Thornton, very important for this book. And then from Africa, I move on and I cross the Atlantic, so to speak, right? And I take my readers to Latin America, to the Caribbean, and then ultimately also to North America, right? Where I demonstrate that the first Black Christians were actually people who, you know, were familiar with this African form of Catholicism. And that also many of the first Black Protestants in North America, were people who came from that community. And that then raises the question, well, what was the impact of these people on, you know, the ongoing evolution of Christianity within Black communities in North America, and that becomes then the final chapter of my book, where I focus on the importance of mutual aid, brotherhoods, in the context of Black Methodist and Baptist churches, and how we could potentially trace those elements back to early forms of brotherhoods, and that essentially then leads to the conclusion of the book. And I think that that gives you a little bit of an overview, right, of how the book is structured.
Yeah, and I've got a couple questions about different aspects that you've just summarized. But what I found really interesting about your book is when, you know, we're comparing or looking at the white Catholics and the Black African Catholics in these African regions and the performances of rituals, right? And so I was wondering if you'd talk about the observations, what you observed when you examined the traditions performed by Black Catholics in Africa, white Catholics, and enslaved Catholics. You know, what were their major changes in how one group of Catholics performed, you know, say a burial ceremony, or how brotherhoods and confraternities were run?
And it's a very good question, Alison, because there are crucial differences here, right? Essentially, what I would say is, you know, had Irish or Catholic German immigrants come to North America in the 16th, 17th century, right? These differences would have been, you know, much less noticeable. But they immigrated later, right? So the point that I tried to the best answer perhaps to your question really is that European Catholics who came to North America, they brought to North America a post-Tridentine form of Catholicism, right? And to these people, a pre-Tridentine form of Catholicism of Portuguese origin, and then particularly a pre-Tridentine form of Portuguese Catholicism mixed with indigenous African elements that to them, right, looked almost like a foreign religion, right? To the point that these Christian elements, these Catholic elements, are hardly recognizable as Catholic to you, right? And I could give an example, Alison. Let me exemplify what I'm trying to say with a reference to funerals, right? And because what do you see in the case of funerals? You see something happening within those Afro-Atlantic Catholic communities, right? What you see is a lot of scenes where people all of a sudden start to dance. And then they start to sing and they laugh and they seem to have fun, right, at a funeral. And I think you agree with me that if you are a 19th century person coming from Ireland and you see that, you consider this disrespectful, right? And if you try to explain it, what comes to your mind is, oh, this is probably some type of indigenous African influence here. Right? This has nothing to do with Christianity. And here I think we have to be careful. It's not that I deny that you know, there may well have been, you know, an importance here when it comes to indigenous African influences, but we should not forget that in pre-Tridentine Catholicism, yeah, this was very common. This was very common in the sense that people were convinced, Alison, that saints hated sadness. Saints hated sadness. And why was that? Because people believed that saints considered grief a form of human protest against decisions, right, that humans could not understand. And for this reason, right, people believed that it was important to break the sadness, even during funerals, in order not to upset the saints. Yeah. And people were concerned with that because the conviction was that saints can be vengeful, they can be jealous, they can be annoying, and they can punish you. So it was important to constantly, you know, be aware of that, that you could not upset the saints, and if you would do so, this could have consequences. Yeah. And this is the point I would want to stress, right? If you see this happening, and you're unfamiliar with these traditions, you're inclined to say, well, this has nothing to do with Christianity. It's nothing to do with Catholicism. And the reality is it does, right? It reflects a pre-Tridentine understanding of the divine that was very common in Iberian Catholicism. But then, of course, Catholicism evolves, right? It changes, and it also changes in a place like Portugal, and to the point that when Portuguese themselves in later centuries come to Africa and see scenes that once upon a time, you know, were introduced by Portuguese many centuries earlier, they don't recognize these Catholic elements any longer, or they think they're ridiculous. They see it as a form of decadence, right? And I think the same happens here in North America, that Irish people or you know, Italian Catholics, all of this felt very, very foreign to them, and the same, of course, happened with these Black communities, right? The Roman Catholic Church, the post Tridentine Roman Catholic Church, also felt very different to them. Yeah, it also felt like a foreign religion almost to them, right? You know, this is, of course, a whole other story, but I feel in a way this helps us also, Alison, to understand why Catholicism is today facing such a crisis in places such as Latin America or Africa, right? And I think part of the explanation here is that there was this tendency to impose, you know, Catholic orthodoxy. To impose, you know, one specific understanding of what Catholicism was supposed to be, rather than understanding and accepting that Catholicism is a house with many rooms, right? And that people should have the freedom to express their understanding of Catholic faith in a way that they think is right. But unfortunately, I think it took a while for the Catholic Church to learn that message. And this partially then I think also contributed to this lack of understanding, this neglect, and in Latin America, even a very aggressive approach against these Afro-Atlantic expressions of Catholic faith by the Catholic Church itself, right?
Yeah, and you know, I think also that could be applied to you know, Catholic studies, this lack of understanding of this area you're diving into. And that, you know, leads me into my next question too. You know, you've now mentioned a couple times that, you know, previous scholarship has, when discussing, you know, slave religion, the focus has been on the influence of indigenous faith or Protestantism. But, you know, there clearly from your book, there were enslaved Catholics, and they weren't just isolated to areas like Louisiana. They were all over the country, as you explain. But so what can you tell us about the enslaved Catholics that you write about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, I would say the crucial point here is that previous studies are not wrong, right? In highlighting the importance of missionaries, in highlighting the importance of indigenous African religious influences. All of that is important. But again, what we need to stress is that we need to add this third element to the discussion, namely the fact that among the earliest enslaved communities, a significant number of people already identified as Christian, right? And there were to influence the way Christianity would evolve within Black communities, including here in North America, right? And there's evidence of that in Manhattan. There's evidence of that in South Carolina, Georgia. Very interesting sources from the Sea Islands, for instance. But unfortunately, very limited in the information they give us, right? Because it's very difficult for us to answer the question, how did this Catholicism look like, right? Because we don't really know. What we can do, and what I did in my book, again, is using a comparative analysis, right? And say, well, it was probably similar to the type of Catholicism that existed in the Cape Verde Islands, that existed in the region of Congo, right? Or what I also do is I look for other places where we find evidence of a significant presence of Afro-Atlantic Catholics, and where we're lucky in the sense that we do have more sources. And one such place, fascinating place, Alison, is the Danish Virgin Islands, where we had missionaries from the Moravian Church operating. And you know, in the assumption that they are the first to, so to speak, you know, bring the message and the gospel and Jesus to these enslaved communities, only to find out that many of them were already familiar with Christianity. They had their own understanding of Christianity, and in these writings of these missionaries from the Moravian Church, you learn, right, about how these communities were organized, how they would essentially honor their own understanding of Christian faith. And that helps us, I think, to then at least get an idea, right, of how communities in Manhattan in the 17th century or on the South Carolina Sea Islands may have lived their Christian faith. And just to conclude this question, what really comes back again and again, Alison, is the term brotherhood, right? Is the fact that these people perceive themselves as a community of brothers and sisters, right? The importance they give to mutual aid, the importance of solidarity, not just with living members, but also with deceased members of the community. Those are elements that time and again are repeated and definitely must have been of crucial importance to these earliest African Christians to arrive in Manhattan, to arrive in South Carolina, for instance.
You end the book by looking at the long-term influence of these Afro-Atlantic Catholics on the development of both, you know, African fraternal traditions and evangelical churches. What did their legacy look like when applied to religious traditions?
Yeah. That's, of course, the most difficult question I tackled in my book, perhaps also the most controversial chapter of my book, admittedly also the most speculative chapter of my book. But look, right? Look, Alison, when I read, for instance, the work of someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, right? And then he writes about Black Protestant churches in the late 19th century. And he writes, what really singles out these churches is that they are, and I quote here, they are a center of social intercourse to a degree unknown in white churches. or he writes that all movements for social betterment are apt to center in these churches, or that beneficial societies in endless number are being formed in these early Black Protestant churches, right? Or when I look at the work of someone like Franklin Frazier, who in, you know, The Negro Church in America, very important book from 1964, also explains, right, the popularity of Black evangelical churches with reference to the provision of social aid and social cohesion, right? Then what do I find there? I find there essential characteristics of brotherhoods. Yeah. And I don't think that is a coincidence. Yeah. I think that these churches built on something that was already there. Yeah. And I'm not the first one saying that. But what earlier scholars have said is, well, it was already there because it was an indigenous African form of mutual aid. And I don't want to deny that. But what I want to say is that, well, let us also look at another possibility. Let us also look at the possibility that these potentially were earlier forms of Afro-Catholic brotherhoods. Right? And that is the place where, you know, Black Methodist, Black Baptist churches were to develop in later centuries. And you know, since we're speculating anyway, Alison, you know, let us perhaps also look at some characteristics of Black communities today in the United States, even among people who are not members of a Christian church, and look at the way African Americans address each other in today's society, using the term brother and sister, right? Or you look at the use of necklaces with crosses that are so popular among African Americans. Look at people organizing vigils with candles when a member of the community dies. Look at the strong solidarity among African Americans, right? More than I would say any other minority group in the United States. And you know, these could all be coincidences, but I do find their parallels to brotherhood traditions, and I don't think this is a coincidence. And you know, if you think about it, right? Brotherhoods, mutual aid societies, it's understandable that such organizations were of crucial importance to a community that has a history of slavery, right? Because where do you find solidarity as an enslaved person? The only people really you could trust as an enslaved person were people of your own community, right? The only ones you could trust was each other. That was all they had, right? Hence, I think the importance of mutual aid societies, brotherhoods, can't be stressed enough. And I must also say that in the context of my research, I came across the work of a scholar I wasn't familiar with before writing this book. His name is John Gigi, and he paid a lot of attention to the role of brotherhoods in Black evangelical churches, and I was fascinated by it. And I think there's a very interesting connection to be made between his research and the theories I present in my book.
Yeah, and I think we have time for one more question, as I see the time's running out. But, you know, what are you currently working on? This might be a tough question since the book just came out, but are there any lingering questions from your work on Afro-Atlantic Catholics that you're planning on pursuing, or has your work taken a new direction?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a very, very busy and hardworking person, Alison, and doing research is really my passion. Currently, maybe what I could share with people who are listening to us is that I'm doing some research on a place I find increasingly fascinating But very little research has been done about that place. And the place is an island. It's a tiny little island in the Atlantic, an African island. The name of the island is Annobón. Annobón. Many people have probably never heard of it. It used to be a Portuguese colony. It later became a Spanish colony. It's part of Equatorial Guinea today. But it has a fascinating religious history. And maybe I could highlight one aspect that really fascinates me for our audience. Is that what you have on this island is that you had an African community that embraced its kind of its own form of Catholicism that had been introduced there by the Portuguese. But then the community didn't have a priest, so they essentially took Catholicism in their own hands, right? And they developed their own form of Catholicism, but then faced a very fascinating problem. And that problem was that nobody could read on the island, right? Nobody could read on the island. And if you can't read, Alison, then you have a major problem in knowing, when do we have to celebrate the saints? If we can't read, how do we know when Christmas is, right? And this is a tropical island, so there's no winter, there's no summer, the weather is always the same. And what I found out is that they developed a very ingenious form of a calendar using a piece of wood with carvings, and that would help them to find out, even though they couldn't read, to find out what day of the year it was and when Christmas would come and what would be the first day of the year, etc. It's just one example, right, of that to me is so fascinating to see what people in Africa would do, right? The length they would go to honor their understanding of Catholic faith, and at the same time, how little we know about this history, history that has been pretty much forgotten, that very few scholars have paid attention to. And perhaps this is also the final point I would like to make, that what I'm presenting here is perhaps much more than just a book. It is a potential department, right? That we could establish, because that's really what I would love to happen. That I would love someone to come and help me, right? Building a department here and with graduate students assisting me exploring important archives all over the world. So my focus was primarily on Portugal, but so much more can be discovered in the Vatican, in Seville, and thinking also archives of the Moravian Church. There's just so much work that still needs to be done. Also works in terms of field work, right? Would love to have graduate students working with me in the Cape Verde Islands, in Annobón, in Angola, in Brazil, and help me to get a better understanding of the still existing brotherhoods that exist in those places. Because understanding those organizations implies a better understanding of the early history of Christianity in Africa and the African diaspora, including here in North America. And there is, Alison, this is a form of urgency here, right? Because sadly, these mutual aid associations that developed out of Catholic lay brotherhoods, these mutual aid societies are disappearing. They're disappearing like snow in the sun. And this has to do, of course, with the explosive growth of Pentecostal churches in Africa, in Latin America, that offer people a modern form of brotherhood, you could say. But the price people pay is that if you join such a church, then you're expected to turn your back to all African and Catholic aspects of your legacy. right? So this is what I would love to do, Allison. But unfortunately, you know, my time is limited. I'm also the director of the Institute of European Studies, so I have a lot of administrative tasks. But as I said, I hope that one day this book will be more than just a book. It will give birth to a new department, and that would be.
Yeah, and you know, that would be I would be very interested in seeing the scholarship that would be produced in such a department if it was formed. But Jérôme, thank you for being on the show. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It was a pleasure to be with you, Allison. I hope people will enjoy reading the book. And who knows, maybe in a couple of years we meet again with some research on this fascinating topic.
Yeah. Well, this has been New Books in Catholic Studies, a New Books Network podcast.